70 years ago, WQED became America's first community-supported public television station. Since then, we've expanded our service to the community through classical music, educational activities, podcasts, and community events. We'll continue to serve the needs of our neighbors, but we need your help. Invest in WQED in any amount today in honor of Public Media Giving Days. Then spread the word. Text, post, or call your neighbors and friends and encourage them to make a donation too. Each contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $15,000 thanks to a generous match from the WQED Board of Directors. Do your part now.
Christine McIntyre, welcome back to Pittsburgh. It's almost like a second home for you. Know, I love it when you come back to Pittsburgh.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. I think this will be my 10th or 11th show. I was trying to add them up the other night just to figure it out. I know, right? And
right.
It's been and over a course of many years, which is sort of the great thing.
Well, I think what's exciting is Pittsburgh Opera enjoys your work. And of course, we as an audience enjoy your work. And now we get to see something that Pittsburgh Opera has never done before, Dvorak's Rusalka. How are you going to approach this piece?
One of the things that always interests me when we're talking about fairy tales or, you know, any opera that's derived from fairy tale is why do we tell these stories? What is a fairy tale and sort of what use are they? And I'm always really fascinated to sort of uncover the psychology behind them. They're such interesting things, fairy tales, you know. So separate from myths, which are always about gods and kings and, you know, fairy tales are domestic in many ways. I'm really fascinated by the history of how they've sort of come into popular culture. And then kind of the human lessons that we can draw from them. And I think that's what's interesting about Rusalka is that it's a story that we all know, of course, the, you know, Little Mermaid. But even sort of beyond that, the idea of a non-human creature who looks on the human world with passion and envy and wants to be part of it in some way, and in their interaction with us, teaches us something about what it is to be human. That's what I think is sort of essential to the story. And that even though she's a water sprite and her father is a water gnome and whatnot, we see this very beautiful, very painful father-daughter relationship. Fairy tales are often about a young woman's transition from girlhood to womanhood. So there are lots of interesting things to kind of take apart in that.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, thank you. No, that's wonderful. Of course, we think of fairy tales and how they're supposed to teach us lessons somehow, but what a wonderful way to think of it as first a transition from a young woman to femalehood or womanhood and then falling in love with someone who is not attainable, unattainable, really.
Yeah, and so inappropriate. And her father sees it, you know, and has that painful thing where he has to let her go. You know, I mean, all parents go through this, that, you know, the what it is to be a parent is to let a child make their own mistakes at some level. And it is very painful for Vodnik to do that. And yes, the prince, you know, and you know, the prince is a hard character to wrap your head around and to defend. You know, he's a bit of an idiot, to be perfectly honest. And certainly he has his head in the clouds. He actually calls her my fairy tale, right? I mean, he's only interested in kind of what is mystical and different about her. He doesn't actually make any attempt to, I don't know, get to know her. Mm-hmm. I guess the fact that she can't talk makes it challenging. But and no one seems terribly concerned about the fact that she's given up her voice. She has literally embraced voicelessness in order to have this man. And in that, I think she has just made the most human-female bargain going, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. The ultimate sacrifice, because her voice is
the ultimate
beautiful.
Sacrifice,
yeah.
her literally her sense of self, right, in order to have him. It's something actually about the tale that is not talked about very much. I read all of this criticism of it and, like, you know, other people's, like, study guides to it, and they want to talk about how it's about Czech nationalism and all this stuff, and nobody's, like, dealing with the essential feminist element of this poor girl gave up her ability to talk in order to get a guy, and nobody seems to notice.
Right, right. And then you have this foreign princess, and all of these characters, we really don't, the father and the daughter have names. Everybody else is a descriptive.
Well, actually, actually, even Rzalka and Vodnik are descriptives. The name, the term Vodnik means water gnome,
okay,
and the name Rzalka actually means water sprite. So nobody in the character in the opera actually has a proper name. Yezhi Baba means witch, you know, and then you have prince and princess. So it's just that some of the characters we refer to in their Czech terminology. So it's interesting, and that puts it very much in the realm of fairy tale, is that they are all, you know, archetypes of something, you know. But, you know, the fact that Disney felt the need to name her Ariel is very interesting, because Hans Christian Andersen didn't, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, but Disney always sort of, you know, there's going to be a happy ending instead of tragic.
It is, and it's interesting because in the original Hans Christian Andersen, it has a very specifically Christian bent. She's actually not after the love of the prince; she's after having a human soul.
Mm-hmm.
And it does eventually have a happy ending, but she sort of goes to a kind of mermaid spirit purgatory until she does enough good deeds. It's a little bit like the Little Mermaid meets. What is that? It's a Wonderful Life, right?
Oh, okay.
And so it's like she has to like get her angel wings before she can actually get her soul at the end of the original Hans Christian Andersen. It's kind of strange. But yes, Disney, by saying, you know, oh, it has to have a happy ending, actually puts it in line with what fairy tales are supposed to do, which is they recognize the harshness of the world, but they give us hope, right?
Right.
And so there is the hope that the beautiful but unseen daughter will get to marry the prince. The prince who has been turned into a frog will have his curse removed. The beast will, you know, be able to transition from beastliness and find true love, all of that. And so in a way, the Rzalka is then in the hands of Dvořák and Kvasil, becomes a little unfairy tale like, because we are sort of denied the happy ending.
Well, or is it they are together in spirit or whatever, going down to the depths, the bottom of the lake, but they are wrapped around each other?
Yeah, I mean, he's technically dead and she's technically not, so...
Oh,
you know,
I guess there is that.
You can sort of define it however you want to. I get the sense much more that it's that he gives in to his ultimate fate, and then she is sort of left to sort of wander in the netherworld.
I see.
But you put a nice, more romantic gloss on it. It has a sort of Titanic, the actors laying on the bed floating to the bottom.
I'm just going to go with that.
Yeah, no. Hey, if that's what you want to see, I see this is the interesting thing about fairy tales is we so as humans so desperately need to see the something beyond our kind of normal reality, right? And that's kind of what these tales sort of play into. And it's interesting that the scholar Marissa Warner, while she writes about them, actually says that there's a German term for them, which translates as wonder tale. And that wonder tale is almost a better name for the general classification of these, because that's what they do, is they inspire wonder in us. And obviously there's usually a fairy or magical element somehow. And then they kind of transcend our reality in that way.
Mm-hmm. And there's the big challenge. Of course, you don't have a big tank to have everybody swimming around in like
oh
they
God.
Do out.
Do you remember that movie Splash, that really terrible
yes.
Daryl Hannah and Tom Hanks? Yeah. Right? So, yes. Yeah, it's not that. No, indeed.
Well, isn't there O-E-A-U out in Las Vegas, too?
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, if Christopher Hahn would give me a huge tank and we could flood the Benedict with water, I would be perfectly happy and think it was really interesting. But that's probably not on the cards. The production uses projections to create the various worlds. And one of the things about Rzalka is the audience does have to sort of, you know, go with us and sort of suspend their disbelief, because we have several different worlds that we encounter. We have Rzalka's kind of sister's world of the underwater. We have kind of the forest floor world with the wood sprites and the water gnome who is coming up from the water. You know, Rzalka is sort of a creature that exists kind of on the edge of that water world, right? Usually she's at the base of a tree or something like that. Somehow she's like hauled herself out of the water. So she's not, you know, I mean, in some ways, Little Mermaid is not the greatest analogy because it's a little more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we have the human world of the prince and the foreign princess, and especially in Act Two, his palace and whatnot. And so one of the tricks is sort of negotiating all of these things. Obviously, you don't want Rusalka to just have to, like, you know, sit at the base of a tree all night. So.